Hello and welcome to this edition of the Microrise V Show. I'm Michael Lehman, technology evangelist at the Microsoft Corporation, along with Bob Walsh, president of Safari Software. And you can find out about Microrise V Evangelism at projectglidepath.net and Safari Software at safarisoftware.com, along with Bob's newest book, Clear Blogging, at clearblogging.com. And today we're joined by Clay Nichols of Bungalow Software from his hammock outside his home in Blacksburg, Virginia. Welcome, Clay.
Howdy.
How is it out in the hammock?
It's very nice today.
So what's the weather like in Blacksburg?
We have pretty good weather over here. It's very nice summers, and it's very nice out today. It's probably about 75 degrees, 74 degrees, something like that.
You just want to make all of us in Seattle with the rain jealous.
Well, you know, I used to live in Portland, so I do feel your pain. And actually, I always preferred the weather in Seattle because it's a little bit cooler. Portland gets kind of hot in the summer. People don't realize that, but there's about a month of 90, 95, 98 degree weather. And my wife, when we moved out here, was trying to convince me to move. And I was like, I don't know, the weather's nice in Portland. And she said, there's more days over 90 in Portland and more days over 80 in Blacksburg. So Blacksburg is actually a little bit more temperate in the warmer months.
Wow, sounds great.
More technical than probably most people need.
All right. So, Bob, take it away.
Okay. Hi, Clay. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good. Well, let's start off with a couple things that our listeners probably don't know about you. First off, you've been running your micro ISV since 1995.
Correct.
Secondly, your partner is your wife.
Right.
And third, you're making software that not just is a nice little thing on their computer. This changes their people's whole lives after they've had a stroke or brain injury for the better. Give me some information here about how did you end up in doing this particular software?
Well, back in about 93, 94, or something like that, I wanted to change jobs. Maybe we should go back a little further. Let me know if I get too long here. Originally was very interested in computers back in, 85, 86, I started with a TS-1000, if you remember those, a little membrane keyboard, the Timex Sinclair 1000. Started with the 2K of RAM, and you could get the 16K, big, huge thing to attach on the back that was poorly attached and such. Anyway, I was writing software way back then and was really interested in computers, but probably like maybe a lot of people didn't realize the potential, really. And so I went off to college and started in computer science and ended up getting lured over to the really good scholarships in the telecom engineering department and thought, that's a challenging field, I'll go and do that. So I went and got a degree there, moved off to Portland, met my wife, we got married. I decided, I really want to go back and do software. So I started writing some programs, and the first thing I wrote actually was a program for her to use at work for her patients.
Speech therapist?
Correct. She's a speech therapist.
Okay.
And her idea, because she didn't know enough about computers, she knew a little bit, but not really enough, we'll make something to print out worksheets because it's a pain to copy worksheets. So she was thinking, how can we make speech therapist lives easier? So that was our first program, my actually first VB3 program. Well, after the necessary Hello World program, of course, was that program, and that was horrendously difficult to write. Talking to printers and such is all lots of fun. Anyway, so we wrote that, and then I thought, really what we need is software to let the patient, to work with the patient more. So we wrote a couple of programs for that, and that was our Aphasia Tutor 1, and then I thought, well, we can extend that and make it Aphasia Tutor 2, and we'll have a whole different program, and we can have three programs. Anyway, so I was working on those, and in the meantime, I had gotten a job working with software at another company doing really mainly technical support, which turned out to be an incredible experience. It's just a really, really good experience. My boss was a really, really sharp guy. Anyway, so we just kept writing more programs and kind of doing it on the side. And then at one point, I became dissatisfied with what I was doing in my day job. I didn't feel like it was really helping people. We were doing stuff for video kiosks for banks, and that's all well and good, but I wanted to do something a little bit different. And so I thought, hey, let's go ahead and try this. And we actually weren't making a lot of money when I quit and started working full time. But in my head,
When was that?
That was probably maybe early 1995, late 94, something like that. But I thought, we've got three programs. I can just write, 10 more programs, right? And that'll give us, three times as much revenue. And that's almost enough to live on. So that was my plan. That was insane, but that was my plan. Luckily, our sales per program actually went up a lot once I quit my job and was there during the day. And I don't know if that's because there needs to be somebody during the day just to give you, you know, a sense of reality. You know, the customers, you know, somebody on the phone and that kind of thing. Or whether it's because I started doing a lot of marketing. And what I found was really useful is I would kind of cycle through every 3 months or so. I would do like marketing and website. Kind of imagine, if you imagine running a company, at least this is the way I do, as you've got a graph, and on the horizontal axis you've got, let's say, revenue per program, and on the vertical you've got number of programs, which is overly simplistic. Mm-hmm. But so my idea was maximize that surface area. So you don't want to just write one program and do marketing for 10 years, because then you get a line and you get zero, you know, you get one times whatever that marketing is. So you wrote three programs, and I did marketing to expand that square, that rectangle. Did that for a while, maybe 3 or 4 months, and then I would stop the marketing and go back and write another program, and then we were up to four programs, and then after I finished that, I would go back and start working on marketing, basically tweaking things, but also marketing this new program. We also went through some, you know, sort of stair step advances where we, you know, first we had three programs and no literature, then we had four or five programs and we had a little brochure, then we got too big for the brochure, we went to a very small catalog, and then we went to a bigger catalog, et cetera. So there's just some sort of stepwise advancements all along the way like that.
Well, it sounds like what you're doing there, or what you did there, to be precise, is you're going back and forth switching hats between, you know, developer programmer for
exactly.
a while, then marketing person for a while,
yep.
rather than trying to stick both those hats on your head at the same time.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to switch back and forth. It's also a lot more interesting because there's a couple of benefits to this. One is it keeps it more interesting. And the second benefit, because you're also focused, just doing programming and a little bit of technical support. And in the early days, we didn't have a lot. We actually still don't have a lot of technical support needs. But in the early days, we didn't have many sales calls coming in, which is actually a bad thing compared to today. But on a day-to-day basis, I didn't really have a lot to do to maintain the business. It was all about expanding it. But the other benefit is that you're never waiting by the phone. So you're never like, okay, we released our new version. Okay, sit back and twiddle your thumbs. You're also never waiting in the sense of, okay, I did all this marketing, did a mail out, whatever, tried whatever kind of marketing technique, and then you're waiting for what it's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather be doing something else to keep myself busy, and that worked really, really well. I'm a very impatient person, and it was a really good way to deal with my impatience because it always gave me something to do. So, yeah, I think it was helpful for lots of reasons.
Well, I like your idea of having multiple programs out there to basically have multiple multipliers of your marketing.
Yep.
Because, A, as external conditions changed from back in 95 to now, basically as the internet just grew and grew and grew, you know, the water would rise and lift all your boats.
Right.
And at the same time, every bit of marketing that you do is actually going to help your sales across each of the products you've got out there.
Yep.
You know, I looked at your product line, and I'm obviously not any sort of medical professional, but I see there's a real theme there. You're working a particular area for a particular type of need that certain people have, but there's a lot of variety there. I mean, you've got a real range of, I counted at one point, I think at now 23 programs?
Something like that, yeah. It depends on how you count them. We have some programs where we have like an out loud version and a non-out loud and things like that, where we sort of added some sort of functionality, and the earlier program actually is kind of replaced by the newer one. But that gives you several price points, too, so people, if they don't want to spend a lot or they don't have a sound card, they can get the cheaper program, that kind of thing. And that's a really good point about the theme, because I have seen people who are like, oh, I'm going to do a second program, but it's not addressing the same market that they're marketing to. And the programs don't have to really necessarily work together or even do the same sorts of things. But what you're trying to do, or what we try to do, is to leverage your marketing efforts. So I could make two completely different kinds of programs as long as they were targeting the same market. So, for example, if I were just marketing to rehab departments, okay, mm-hmm. a whole department. I could write a speech therapy program, and if I wrote a physical therapy program, and there is one out there called PhysX, and we almost carried it for a while, but it was actually like the program I told you about for printing worksheets. It's somebody okay. whose focus, and not to knock the program, but their focus was, well, what can I do for therapists? So it was for printing out worksheets and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Unfortunately, that's okay. half the market because you want the patients as well. So the trick is how can what else can I produce that I could just add on to all my literature and to my website and still reach pretty much the same people? And that's when okay. you're really leveraging your marketing. Well, people don't realize marketing is the hard part, really. They think the software is, but as you probably discovered with your ISV, I think the marketing is the much more challenging part.
Well, I think for developers especially, because there's a developer attitude or arrogance or presumption that, you know, basically marketing people are slime and that anything that comes out of their mouth shouldn't be believed because, you know, it's just marketing. And when it comes time to actually turn around and go, oh my God, if I don't make some money here, I am screwed badly. Mm-hmm. And then you have to start thinking like a marketer mm-hmm. where you're trying to think like somebody you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You know, not many people can jump that hurdle. You have to get over the hurdle that marketing is not necessarily a bad thing. It's all in how you do it.
Well, and it's not that marketing is a bad thing necessarily. It's that there are lots of, you've seen the stats on, the performance capability of programs, you know, several orders of magnitude from the worst guy to the best guy. Well, mm-hmm. marketing and sales is no different, really. The guy that's working at Radio Shack, not Radio Shack or the wonderful people there, unfortunately, the example, the people I'm talking about probably aren't there anymore because I think they're very transitory. But compared to a guy selling, I don't know, yachts or something at the very high end, or my neighbor who's a really sharp sales guy, there's orders of magnitude, probably even more than with programmers. Because the difference between mm-hmm. selling a cell phone, because that's what they always want to sell you when you go in there, and selling a yacht. And the deal is that most people, I know I had this view, think that's what sales is, and they think that's what marketing is. So they think that sales and marketing is what's represented by kind of the worst, because we see that the most. We notice it the most. Good mm-hmm. sales and marketing, much like a good UI, is unnoticeable. It just works. It really does. You don't even realize somebody's selling you something because they're really not. What they're doing is saying, mm-hmm. what are your needs? I'm going to figure out how to meet your needs. So if that's your view of sales and marketing and you think, how can I think like those people? Yeah, it kind of turns your stomach because you're like, well, I don't want to be like that. And it's uncomfortable for the customer. And if I have any empathy, and you can't really do it unless you have empathy, mm-hmm. you're going to feel slimy. But once you mm-hmm. realize, and if you read some of the stuff out there, once you realize that sales and marketing is really about, how do I reach the right people? They want to be reached. You know, mm-hmm. I used to joke, I was so impressed when Google AdWords came out, because I'd been saying this for years, not with online stuff, but just in general, that if I get something I requested on knitting, okay, by accident, that's spam to me. That's junk mail, because I'm not interested in knitting. But if you mail me a catalog on rock climbing, even though I didn't request it, that's valuable. So it's not about whether I requested it. It's about whether I'm interested in it. So marketing, mm-hmm. in my opinion, is about finding out about, of all those needles and haystacks, which ones would be interested. Because when I put something in front of a stroke survivor that says, hey, try this out. It's free. It can help you talk better. It can help you speak better. That's valuable to them. And that's not slimy marketing. That's just smart putting, you know, the right people together.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you have two different markets mm-hmm. from what I see here. You have
right.
your stroke survivors and related people in that circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have your medical professionals, which is an entirely different type of kettle of fish.
Right.
And I'm wondering, do you end up with some tension there between, well, stroke survivors who say, you know, my therapist doesn't know what they're doing, and therapists who say, oh, wait a second here. You know, we're the experts. Why are you laying the software into the hands of the people that we know how to help and we have the degree to prove it?
Right. Well, there's certainly the potential for that. And luckily, I have my wife as credentials, so to speak. And she's actually very, very good. She's very, very modest, and she thinks she's just a typical speech therapist. But I think she's extraordinarily good. And she's really perceptive about diagnostics, which is very critical in anything, but especially in something like this. We actually, the tension isn't as marked as what you described. It's more a matter of, from our perspective, I'm looking at from our perspective, when we got started, was what credibility do you have? Now, that was actually easy because I could say, these were designed and developed and tested and used by speech therapists. Even though I wrote most of the programs, my wife was heavily involved. You know, they talk about in rapid application development that, you know, the best thing to do is have the customer, you know, right, readily available. Well, my wife was right there sitting next to me. Anytime I had a question, I could ask her. And luckily, I was working at night to begin with, so she was always right there. And I could say, well, you know, what about this? What about that? And see what she thought. So that also lets me say these were developed by speech therapists, because they were.
Well, you know, it sounds like they're, I mean, to be blunt, you wouldn't be as successful as you are right now if you hadn't had, shall we say, a resident content expert on board.
Absolutely.
And that really was one of your competitive advantages over
a
lot of other people who have tried to do this.
Yep. Most people, and you've seen my posts about this, but the domain expertise is far more important than the programming. I'm not an exceptional programmer, although maybe I'm as humble as my wife, but I don't think so. I think she's a better therapist than I am a programmer. Now, I do think I'm a good UI designer, or fairly good. At least I care a lot about it, and I try to always make it better. So I think our strength is not my programming ability. It's her domain knowledge, which is very, very deep and very broad. She also just, you know, and she gets this from her dad, who passed away this summer, but really, you know, when she became a speech therapist, he said, would people pay to do this out of their own pocket if insurance wasn't paying? He's a very sharp guy. And she said, well, I don't know, you know, but it's what I want to do. So her mind, even when she ran a department, was always sort of running it like a business, not in the sense of we got to make money, but in the sense of we need to deliver value. We have customers. We don't have patients. So, you know, she did things like instituting Sunday service and things like that, speech therapy service, which did not make her popular when she ran her department. But she's like, look, if we send the message that we're optional one day a week, we're really optional every day of the week. And that sends a really, really bad message. So, no, absolutely, I attribute all of our success to her. She is very sharp, and domain knowledge is the most important aspect of this. You can't substitute domain knowledge, but you can sometimes substitute or learn the programming as need be.
Okay. Well, given that what you just said, it sounds like there's sort of two implications here for micro-ISVs. One, you can marry somebody who's got domain knowledge, which might not be a bad idea for other reasons. But you can't just write software that you go, well, okay, I'm writing the software, it's nice, I don't care about it really, but, you know, I can write this.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have some passion going. You have to have some emotional connection with the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I'm hearing from you is that not just your wife, but you both have a lot of pride in what you're doing here because you really found a way to make a difference. You're not just writing another, oh, God, let's say another photo organizer. You know,
I thought you were going to say project management task planning tool.
Ooh, nasty. I sell those.
I'm just kidding. I use it. That's why
you're making,
say that.
Yeah, that's true. You're making a... You found a way to connect your core values to the software and the work that you do.
Right. There's a lot
in
of
a
integrity
way
there,
that pays the bills.
Right.
And that seems to give you a whole lot of steam
karmic
to work with.
Karmic cash flow.
Well, positive cash flow is
no,
like,
you think karmic cash flow in the sense of there's some sort of karmic, you know, psychological benefit.
I take your point. I think that's an excellent way of describing it. But I'm wondering, when you get down to the actual business of selling, okay, when you're dealing with the healthcare professionals, any advice you've gleaned from that for other micro ISVs who want to sell to, you know, call it the medical industry for lack of a better term?
Well, you want to definitely know, let me take a step back because there's actually a broader question here. I always tell people, I've said this for years, this is before I even understood Zen and just how important this is before you start a company, first be a customer. First, be the customer. And what I meant was play customer. Go out there and say, if I had this problem, what's out there? How would I find it? How many people are looking for this? That lets you start sort of empathizing with the customer. And that's even more important with the healthcare industry, because you're not selling to an industry, you're not selling to a company, you're selling to a person in that company, and you need to understand the structure. I can deal with retail a lot easier than selling to medical folks, because there's no the structure in selling to a home user is a lot simpler. They might be married, they might have relatives, the caregiver could be wife, husband, daughter, father, whatever. That I understand those relationships, and they're pretty simple. Simple, but they're understandable. But business relationship or business organization, like, okay, I'm selling to a speech therapy department. Who's in charge? Who pays the bills? Who do they look to as a reference source? Those are a lot more opaque to me than a home user would be. So there's there's an idea, in The Design of Everyday Things. I forgot to get the guy's name, but which is a really good book on design.
Donald Norman,
yeah. He talks about the mental model and understanding sort of your mental model and the physical model and trying to make those match up. And, of course, UI is, of course, what's in between those, and it's important for the UI to reflect the physical model, so the mental model just builds itself. But you need to understand the physical model of what's going on inside that organization. So when you sell to them, you understand who you're talking to. Now, the reality is, it turns out that, and we could maybe even do this better, but speech therapists are a technical enough field, and our application is an isolated enough one, that all we really need to do is appeal to the speech therapist and then help them do a cost justification, and then, we can make the sale. They've got the money, they can get the money, and they like it. It's a little different if you're dealing with something like electronic medical records and a lot of more business-oriented systematic systems. Those are much harder to deal with, because everybody knows that there's a network effect, so everybody is selling those really hard and trying to get a toehold. And also, you can't go in there with just a piece of the solution, because that's not the value. The value is every department suddenly using electronic medical records, which means you've got, thousands of different types of screens, but you don't get the benefit from EMR unless everybody's using it. So it's this huge, it's like artificial intelligence. It's like either it's artificially intelligent or it's not. There's no in between. So you kind of have to build this huge thing, and you can't take the JOL approach or the rapid application approach of saying, well, we're going to release the simplest thing that'll work, because the simplest thing that'll work is 20 departments and fully serving every one of those departments, because you can't just do part of the EMR on a computer and part on paper. It's what we used in climbing used to call a committing move, where you jump up for something to grab it, and if you don't make it, you're going to fall. And it's kind of an all-or-nothing gamble. But that's at an extreme that's different than us. If you're selling a utility, I think, honestly, it's about appealing to the therapist and understanding how they're going to make that purchase. Well, and one of the things is, for example, our products are priced below the capital budget level. So a therapist can expense one of our programs. Now, we also sell packages, and those are always nice to have somebody write one big check. But a therapist can go out and just buy one or two of our programs, and they don't have to go through a year-long budget cycle. We've had therapists take up to the longest was like 9 years to order. They had our old red square diskettes from the 1995 or 96 or something like that, Asher conference. I'm like, well, the good news is, or the bad news is, the prices have gone up. The good news is the programs are so much better than they were back then.
Clay, let me jump in here and ask a couple of questions. We started out the program talking about you sitting on your hammock in the backyard. And you said you run bungalow software with your wife. Do you run it out of your home?
I do, out of the basement.
So I'd be interested in just sort of getting your perspective on that. I've done that before as a micro ISV myself. And what advice would you have? First of all, what's your experience of that? And second of all, what's your advice for other micro ISVs on what to do and what not to do about running a business out of your house with your spouse?
Right. Well, first of all, just location within the house. If you're going to run a business that has a lot of electronics and things producing heat, and we have now, I don't know, like three or four computers and far too many printers. Everyone seems to have a special use. Don't put it in the attic. That's where we start. Well, we started in the basement, moved to a second house in Portland that was much bigger. I ended up being in the attic because it had a second master bedroom, which seemed like a smart idea. You'd think having actually taken thermodynamics, I would understand that heat rises, and with a south-facing window and no ventilation, it got so hot in there, I just had to shut the business down like at 2 in the afternoon because it was just ungodly hot. So that's the first rule is down is better. Basement's very nice because the coolness of the basement contrasts nicely with the heat. I cannot imagine having a business in the home without having it very isolated. You know, being upstairs or downstairs, the stairs themselves are sort of a psychological barrier. Having a door is also a barrier. You can lock it if you have to. It also would probably be way more difficult if we were starting, where you're trying to get your focus and all that kind of thing, with kids. We started without kids. And my wife loves to tell the story of being on the phone with a customer, and in the background she can hear, "Mommy, I just pooped. Can you wipe me?" So that's a little distracting. But in general, actually works well. I have a wife who understands how difficult what I do is, and has done enough of it herself that she's, you know, a lot of micro-ISVs talk about, my wife thinks I'm just playing video games downstairs. She doesn't understand that I need time to work on this. I'm lucky that my wife has always understood that. And in fact, she's the one saying, don't work so hard, you know, just come upstairs, just, you know, let the phone ring, or whatever. So that's my overview of how that works.
All right, that sounds good. And is it something that you would recommend to people to go into business with your spouse? Is it something that you've found? I know that she's a subject matter expert here, but has it been a good thing for your family life?
I think it has. It's something we both believe in. So our values are aligned with that. So that's a really good thing. Honestly, the biggest problem is just that I enjoy it that so much, and it's something I'm good at. Because, you know, I'm answering questions for people based on stuff that I created, so I happen to be the subject matter expert, that having it that close, it's really tempting to work more than I should be. And in fact, I've been trying to do this for a long time, based, I think, on the Getting Things Done book. I think it's where I heard it, but trying to work just 20 hours a week. So even though I'm out in the hammock, I actually work a lot. And this week, I'm actually really trying to stick to my guns and say, I'm only going to work 6 hours a day. I work more than that, then I have to work less the next day. So that's really, honestly, the bigger risk is not so much being in business with your spouse, it's having your business so close that it's easy to get an idea and run down and work on it. And that's fine in the beginning because you need to do that. You need that efficiency. Once you've crossed the hurdle and you're doing well enough, it's too tempting to do too much. So that's the downside. And we may eventually move out of the house just to give me that isolation, and so I can't just jump into work.
Yeah, that was the same kind of experience that I had with that. In terms of starting a micro ISV, you started this one obviously with your spouse at the same time with your wife. Mm-hmm. How do you guys split the non technical jobs in terms of marketing and sales and technical support and things like that, or is that how does that work for you two?
Yeah, she, and this, of course, goes back to how do you break something up into pieces. And I used to teach this, teaching software engineering, the analogy I used to use with the bicycle, you know, when you're trying to modularize things. So you need to break it along, you know, clear lines, break it into pieces that don't need to talk to each other, right? So my wife does the accounting because luckily, although I'm the one with the technical degree and all the math background, in fact, she jokes that, you know, it's a good thing that I'm around, because when it comes to teaching kids algebra, I was trying to teach my cousin algebra the other day, or rather my nephew, that she can't even remember that stuff. But when it comes to doing things like balancing a checkbook, she's got that attention to detail, and she can just, you know, she loves doing like forensic accounting and stuff. So how we broke it up is she does all the accounting, which thank God, because I could not do that. That's just, I just hate doing that. I can do it, but I hate it. And I do, basically these days, I do everything else. She spends about a day a week in the office. We're trying to actually reduce that for all of us. We've hired somebody for the summer that I think is going to be a teacher who's off during the summer. By the way, that's a great, we've just kind of really figured that out, that, oh, teachers, that's a great source of part-time help. Because our big problem isn't so much that we need help every day, it's that we need help with vacations. And now that we've got kids in school, that means summer. Well, duh. The teachers are a perfect market. They're smart. They're used to dealing with stressful environments. They've got good customer service skills. And we can pay them really well compared to what they make during the year. And they've got the summer off. And they might want to work just 2 months or 3 months or whatever, or maybe even less than that. And I'd be happy to hire them all summer. We'll just take vacations all summer. So we've got a gal who's our old babysitter, our old nanny, who just got her master's. So she'll be working for us this summer. I forgot the question.
Well, let me go on to another question here.
Okay.
Clay. You started back in the days of EB3.
Uh-huh. I'm still in the days of EB3, if you can imagine that.
Oh. Well, let me ask it this way. Where are you technically now in terms of your coding environment, your languages, and where are you going?
Well, as you're probably well aware, there's this huge vacuum, and please make sure Delphi gets this, of development tools for shrink-wrap software. You know, Microsoft stopped supporting VB6. Delphi jumped on the .NET bandwagon and kind of abandoned, in my opinion, the shrink-wrap 32-bit environment. And they still support it, but they're not doing a lot of new stuff with it. So technically where we are is we are moving to VB.NET. We'll be using some sort of linker, so we will have to lug around a 32 megabyte or whatever runtime, but it'll be compressed, so it'll be doable. And so we are actually writing one new program. It's kind of a variation of one of our most popular programs in VB.NET, and I've got a programmer that's working on that. And so we'll slowly start moving to VB.NET. I keep thinking with every version of Windows that, our VB3 stuff's going to stop working, but all it takes is a little tweaking usually, and I can get it working again. And that's the advantage of having that expertise in-house, is that, a couple of weeks of work means all of a sudden we're still in business and not having to deal with stuff not working on Vista or whatever.
So Vista was not a life-threatening event for you?
It was not. We had to change things, and mostly with registration and where, directory
permission. Yeah, I had that same issue. That was the only issue that came up for me was they renamed my documents to documents and changed the path a bit. And that was the only issue out of everything imaginable that happened. Well, let me ask, so you're working now in .NET.
Mm-hmm.
And I could ask the obvious question of how you like it, but instead I'd like to ask you a different question. You've got a code base that goes back, 12 years.
Yep.
How are you managing this? Because if I were doing it before I started doing the things I do, I would have about 10 billion copies of it on 13 servers and hard disks and just go crazy. How have you managed your code base? Because that's really, the core of your crown jewels there.
Right. We never branch. That's one thing. I know a lot of companies that deal with having multiple branches of code. Anytime we need some new functionality, and every now and then we've had to do something special for a customer, I agree with Joel on this, that is the bane. You don't want to be doing that because it's just not worth the effort.
Well,
now and then we have to do that. I never branch it. I always just put in, options, so that I can say, if this command line flag is whatever, then do this special thing.
Okay.
So I've really not had to deal with multiple versions. It's always just been one version, and then maybe I'll have a couple of versions back from that, more as an undo or a reference, but I don't actually use that old code.
Something we should probably clarify, I'm sure 95% of the people listening to this podcast know who Joel is.
Joel is
Joel Spolsky, Joel on Software, and one of the forums he runs is called the Business of Software Forum. I'm co-moderator along with Eric Sink, who came up with the title or the term MicroISV. I'm wondering, because you're known there pretty well, too, and I'm wondering, what have you gotten out of the Business of Software Forum, and what do you think of it?
Well, I think it's great. I was actually looking for something like that for many, many years, and then stumbled upon Joel's writings, and then eventually that actual forum, Business of Software, got started, because it wasn't originally. Originally, the forum was just people discussing Joel's writing.
Mm-hmm.
And first and foremost, what I've got out of it, honestly, is camaraderie. Working alone is good and bad. It's good because you don't have to work with people you don't like. It's bad because you don't get to work with people you do like. And honestly, people talk about, you know, a friend of mine did use our company for his MVP project, and everybody in his class said, "Oh, why don't they expand?" And I said, "You know," and my thought was, the only reason to expand is, and I finally realized this, is so I could work more with people that I liked. You know, so I see somebody like, "Oh, I like working with this guy. How can we figure out how to make that happen?" But so what I've gotten out of it is primarily camaraderie, but also just sort of a reality checks. Like, I'll be like, "Well, I'm going to do X, Y, Z thing. Here's some options. What do people think about this?" And also, there's some really deep technical knowledge and other knowledge on that forum. And also, they're all articulate people, so they're pleasant. You know, their writings are pleasant. They're usually, what would you call it? They're for the most part well tempered in how they're responding. So you don't have the effect that you have in some technology oriented forums where everything turns into a Linux, Microsoft, or Linux, Windows argument, you know, or Mac, PC, or whatever. So they're a little bit more mature, a little less geeky, I guess.
Okay. Well, let's ask one last question for today. What advice would you like to give to other micro ISVs?
That broad. I would say first, like I said before, first be a customer. Be a customer, and everything needs to center on the customer. So when people are like, "Should I quit my job and work on my ISV?" It's like, yes, as soon as you've got a customer paying you money. Because first step is to be a customer. Second step is to be in touch with customers. Next step is make something the customer would be willing to pay you for. Next step is figure out a way to get a customer who has never heard of you. They're not your brother. They didn't hear about you through whatever, to pay you money. You know, we used to sell out software to therapists that Terry knew, and it was fine to have that money coming in, but it wasn't there wasn't sort of a confidence building from that. Because I'm like, well, these sales don't count. These are not proof of concept. Because they may have bought this because they knew you. If I can go out and get an unknown person to find us on the web or whatever and buy the software, I can then replicate that. I could not replicate selling to Terry's business folk therapist that knew her, because she only knows so many. So once you can do that, once you figure it out, and whether that's mailing out catalogs, Google AdWords, whatever, once you said, okay, we can spend X dollars and get Y revenue, that's when you know you've actually got a business. Most people get it backwards. You know, they think what a business is a building, a secretary, a desk, and a computer. It's like, no, those are things that help you run a business. That's not a business.
All right. Well, Clay, thanks very much for being on the Micro ISV show.
You're welcome.
All right, and this is Michael Lehman, Technology Evangelist at Microsoft, and Bob Walsh, Managing Partner at Safari Software, and we'll see you later on Channel 9.